Newspapers, of course, face plenty of their own challenges, but one newspaper says it's now clawing its way back from the brink. The publisher of the Seattle Times says his paper has started turning a profit. He attributes that to dramatic cost-cutting and to the demise of the city's other print newspaper, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which now exists only online. Deborah Wong from member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
The big open newsroom at the Seattle Times is not as busy a place as it used to be. In recent years, the Times has gone through multiple rounds of layoffs, leaving lots of empty seats.
We have cut $89 million out of expenses in the last 2 years, which is huge for a company our size.
Frank Blevin is the Times publisher. He says the Times has faced the same challenges as many other newspapers, declining ad sales, slumping circulation. But over the past couple of months, he says, it's turned a corner.
Now we're beginning to see some profitability. And as soon as there's any uptick in the economy and any uptick in consumer spending and advertising, we should do very well.
Blevin wouldn't say how big a profit. The Times is privately held and tends to keep its business closely under wraps. But he did say the paper received a big boost when its rival, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, killed its print edition in March. The Times began wooing PI subscribers and won over most of them, lifting circulation by 30%. The PI's move also ended the business relationship between the two papers. Under the joint operating agreement, the Times handled ad sales, printing, and delivery of the two papers, and then had to share the profits with the weaker PI. Blevin had argued the JOA was dragging the Times down.
Now we get to keep 100%, and that makes a huge difference.
But that doesn't mean the Times is out of the woods. The company's still paying off debt from its earlier acquisition of a newspaper chain in Maine. And all the years of cost-cutting have taken a toll. The paper's now noticeably thinner than it was even a few months ago. When it hits the doorstep, it makes a plink rather than a bang. Ken Doctor is a news industry analyst for Outsell, a California-based research firm.
You hold up that paper and it's thinner and thinner. How long before you get to that decision point and you say, it's just too thin? And they're charging me more money, I'm just going to go online.
And that's where there's still competition. The PI may not exist in print anymore, but it's making a go as a scaled-down web-only newspaper with a paid staff of just 20. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Wong in Seattle.
Now to a long-running dispute between Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. They've been fighting over water for nearly two decades. The focus is a reservoir at Lake Lanier, north of Atlanta. Georgia believes it deserves the water. Alabama and Florida say they need the water downstream. Recently, a federal judge gave the states 3 years to resolve their fight. As NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, the judge's ruling is causing a lot of angst in Georgia.
Some 35 miles northeast of Atlanta, not far from Lake Lanier, is the town of Suwanee, Georgia. Mayor Dave Williams shows me around the main gathering place in town.
We are at our town center park, which is what we refer to as our community front lawn. We're right now on the steps of our city hall looking at our fountain, which we call the Big Splash. And there's, about 50 kids out there?
On this hot, sticky day, kids of all ages and some parents run through the fountain's dancing water. Water, the mayor quickly tells me, is recycled. In 1990, 2,400 people lived in Suwanee. Now there are nearly 17,000. The growth here was planned, but there's no doubt the city benefited from a plentiful water supply. Now there's a new worry. Last month, a federal judge ruled that the Lake Lanier Reservoir was built for flood control, navigation, and hydropower, not drinking water. So the judge gave the governors 3 years to negotiate a deal. If they can't, Congress must approve drinking water as an appropriate use, or Georgia must return to the amount it withdrew in the 1970s, when the Atlanta area was only one-third its size. Mayor Williams says going back is not an option.
If you're asking me, do I think we're literally going to have no water, I don't think that's going to be the case. But I don't think that we're going to ever again take for granted the fact that we can build as much as we want and the water is going to be there to be had.
This is absolutely not a discussion over water. This is a discussion over economic development.
Sam Olens is chairman of the Atlanta Regional Commission. He says much has changed since Congress authorized the dam's construction in the 1940s. And Olens says the downstream states are fighting Atlanta's success.
If anyone with a straight face can tell you that Lake Lanier should solely be used for hydropower, flood control and navigation, I'll show you someone who has zero credibility. There is plenty of rain and plenty of water for everyone.
But a recent drought pointed out the problems. Florida is worried about getting enough water for Apalachicola Bay to support its oyster and shrimp industries. Alabama says it needs water to continue the state's growth and maintain its nuclear plant that supplies power to 1.5 million people. Cindy Lowry is with the Alabama Rivers Alliance.
We have to think long term. We have to think 100 years down the road. These are life-sustaining resources. You know, we can technically live without oil or energy, but we can't live without water.
Since the court ruling, pressure has increased for the states to try again. In Washington recently, Alabama's Governor Bob Riley said he's willing to talk.
If three good friends can't sit down together and work out a common solution to this problem, I'm going to be very disappointed. Because I really do think this is a great opportunity. And I hope it's not an opportunity lost.
Florida's Governor Charlie Crist hasn't made any promises.
We got a very good ruling that really benefits Florida, helps our oyster industry in Apalachicola, and helps us with our water. And we're very pleased by that, and we continue to support that ruling.
But Georgia's Governor Sonny Perdue says he's appealing the ruling, lobbying for a congressional solution, and trying to restart water negotiations, talks he's worked on since 2003.
We've been at the table in many discussions since that time, remain willing to do that, but the judge's ruling has more than likely given Alabama and Florida reason to say, why negotiate?
North of Atlanta, the reservoir at Lake Lanier is finally filling up after a 3-year drought. Georgia's governor says as many as 48 reservoirs across the country could pose the same question as this one, because most did not establish drinking water as a purpose when they were built. Perdue says he's ready to play hardball with his neighbors, and he suggests it may be time for a new national policy to resolve the issue. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
$850,000 low-income children in New York State are getting a bonus, $200 each, intended to help cover the cost of back-to-school supplies. The money comes in part from billionaire financier and philanthropist George Soros. Soros has handed out billions in charitable donations over the years. He's also used his fortune to try to move the political dial. In 2004, he fiercely opposed the re-election of George W. Bush, spending more than $15 million and calling the effort the central focus of his life. As Soros announced this latest donation today, he spoke of his own memories of living during tough economic times. And George Soros joins me now from New York. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Why don't you explain for us the idea behind this $35 million gift of yours today? Why do this?
Well, because we are in a particularly difficult period with a very severe recession, and when philanthropy has been badly hit by the financial crisis. And I feel that people who can afford it should step up to the plate and actually increase their philanthropic donations.
And how will this work for a family in New York that gets public assistance or is on food stamps? What will happen to get this money?
That's one of the things that appealed to me, that there are no strings attached and they don't need to apply. It just comes to them.
No strings attached, which I guess also means that the family could use the $200 for anything, really. There's no way to know if they actually will be buying clothes and supplies for school.
That's true, but it is focused on people who are on food stamps and public assistance. And people who are on food stamps are people who normally take care of themselves and now are unemployed or low income or whatever. And I don't think one needs to set additional conditions.
We should explain that your $35 million gift to New York State is being then matched by, what, $140 million federal dollars, emergency funds.
That's right. Basically tapped into the stimulus, because the state has to put up 20% matching funds to earn the stimulus. And the New York State is not in a position to put up this money, because they have to cut their own budget. So they couldn't have done it without my contribution. And so my $35 million becomes $170 million. And that's called leverage. And, of course, we got into trouble by overusing leverage. But in this case, I think leverage is being well used.
This is good leverage.
Yes, I think so.
I gather this was spawned in part by your own experience, memories of your own experience during times of hardship.
Well, what happened was that when I was a recipient of aid or in need of help, and I was a student in London, and I was working at night as a waiter, my tutor found out about it, and she submitted my name to the Quakers. And then I got a check without any strings attached. For £40. And so it gives me a personal satisfaction to be able to do it on a much larger scale.
I'd like to take this chance, Mr. Soros, to talk with you more broadly about the economy and what's going on. Do you think that we are stepping back from the economic precipice? Where are we in this recession right now?
Well, the stimulus and has helped to find a bottom. I think we are going to have a good quarter coming up because of the cash flow clunkers, the scheme. But that's a very temporary lift. I think that the longer-term effects are going to be with us for quite some time, because consumers who have not been saving at all because of the value of the houses going up, and now the value of the houses has gone down, and they must save.
You said you thought the stimulus helped to find the bottom. About 6 months ago, when you were asked about President Obama's stimulus plan, you said it is not enough to turn the situation around. Do you think it's working any better than you thought 6 months ago?
It is actually working better than I thought. And altogether, the Obama administration has chosen to sort of exploit what they call the confidence multiplier to make people feel better. And it is helpful, but there is an underlying reality that, and I think that we are facing a protracted period of slow growth at best. And that has to do with the need for the banks to earn their way out of a hole, which is going to weigh on the economy for years to come.
Well, George Soros, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
As economic models for the news business crack apart, media executives from competing outlets are sharing their headaches behind closed doors at one of the nation's leading journalism schools. NPR's David Folkenflik was recently allowed to observe and offers us this look at the quest to find solutions.
Up on the sixth floor of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, these folks sure don't sound like those arrogant leaders of media giants that we keep hearing about. Richard Porter, director of news content for BBC World News, delivers an update on his efforts to drive some of its millions of TV viewers to its websites.
I'm past the end of the beginning. I don't think I'm greatly much further than that.
Porter is laying out his challenge to 18 other media executives from outlets large and small.
The marketing and creative teams that I work with have really, really got this and bought into it big time.
Among those present are people from news organizations that also have an international reach, the Associated Press, the New York Times, and Time.com. Longtime management consultant Doug Smith says it's pretty clear why these hard-nosed news executives are willing to share their secrets.
It's chaos out there. There's definitely a sense of terror.
Smith is the executive director of the Sulzberger News Media Executive Leadership Program at Columbia, now in its third year. The program helps news companies develop targeted strategies for change. A few months ago, the Christian Science Monitor became the first nationally distributed newspaper to scrap its daily edition in favor of its website. It was considered a radical step for the esteemed but wilting publication, worked out right in front of its peers with Smith's genial guidance.
you're seeing industry change before your eyes. And I think that that makes it rational to say we all want to find a more sustainable future. To some degree, let's find it together.
They adhere to Las Vegas rules. What's said at the J School stays at the J School. One of this year's fellows is Ray Pierce, vice president for circulation at the New York Times. Pierce says the Vegas rules make him comfortable as he shapes his approach to distributing the Times on electronic readers.
We started the program. A lot of the goals were sort of lofty statements and sounded wonderful. And what Doug and his team do is they force you to focus on, okay, that's great, but what are you trying to deliver?
ABC News President David Westin knew what he wanted his executives to remedy. Budget pressures over the past two decades have forced the network to cut back its coverage of foreign news.
Ultimately, we want to put on good stories, wherever they're from. The most interesting, most important stories we can find. But we have to find them. And I was worried that the cost of the major bureaus was getting in the way of our finding those good stories.
The standard for the gold-plated bureau, Westin says, was set under Kennedy White House spokesman turned Paris bureau chief, Pierre Salinger.
And at that point, I am told we had both a wine cellar and a full-time chef.
Those days are long gone. Now you see a cadre of younger, less familiar reporters.
I'm Karen Russo in Surat, India. The global economic crisis has reached the...
They're one-person bands, armed with light digital cameras, and they file stories and raw footage for newscasts, radio, webcasts, and podcasts from eight spots around the world where the network would otherwise have no presence. New media guru Jeff Jarvis admires the innovation, but he says that kind of change may not be radical enough. Jarvis heads the interactive news program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, also here in Manhattan. Jarvis praises the Monitor's decision to kill its daily edition, but asks why the Boston Globe, another participant in the Columbia program, doesn't also consider stopping the presses.
If all we're doing is incrementally fixing problems in the current old models, that's futile and fatal. Saving a little more money or making a few more pennies is not going to bring news into its next generation. We have to reinvent journalism and the news business for a new, profitable future.
But Columbia's Doug Smith says it's unrealistic to think of changing an entire industry. His own prescription involves looking at each news outlet individually. He says you have to fix one company at a time.
Yeah, I think it's terrific when there are panels and forums and opinion pieces and things that throw great ideas into the mix. My experience is that it takes more than ideas to create a sustainable future. You have to implement those ideas.
Smith says they've thrived by turning competitors into collaborators at Columbia. And ABC's David Westin suggests you think this way about the news business during these tough economic times. It's much more like playing golf than tennis. You compete against the course. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
Tomorrow, David reports on ABC's efforts to strike a new tone for a digital audience.